Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, more than 20 million Americans suffer from what's known as enigmatic chronic cough. It's actually one of the most common reasons why somebody would seek medical attention. But unfortunately, many of those 20 plus million are misdiagnosed. And 80% of all asthma diagnoses are incorrect. That's according to Dr. Jamie Kaufman. She's one of America's leading laryngologists, and she joins me around 12:40 to tell you what you should be looking for and how you may be able to self-diagnose once you've ruled out serious diseases. Psychotherapist Wendy Aronson joins me around 12:25 to discuss something many boomers and even Gen Xers are facing right now, and that's the empty nest syndrome. But Dr. Aronson says, don't think of it as an empty nest. You're simply re-feathering it, and it's exciting. First, I am joined by someone who went in search of a cure for his colitis and ADD and maybe even a little East Coast neurosis. Well, that was many years ago. He's now the owner of and director of the Holistic New Leaf Learning Center in Western Massachusetts. He's studied, practiced, and taught yoga, meditation, and Ayurveda for more than 20 years. And along the way, he's authored 12 books, including Misadventures of a Garden State Yogi and Misadventures of a Parenting Yogi. Welcome, Brian Leaf. Brian, welcome.
Thanks so much, Vicki. Thanks a lot. You know, when you first started saying about the 20 million people misdiagnosed with the, I didn't know where you were going with that. I didn't realize you were introducing someone else. I thought you were going to say something about how 20 million people misdiagnosed with something, but it's really just because they're parenting or something like that. Just about how parenting is hard. I thought that's what you were going with that.
That's funny. So sometimes it throws people off when I introduce the whole show up front.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, over, it was probably more than 20 million. I guess it's like 100 million Americans have this sort of strange feeling of ill at ease all the time, and then they realize it's from parenting.
Well, I love that in the front of your book, you have a lot of quotes in the book, but in the front of your book, there's a quote by Louis C.K., and I actually am not a parent myself, but I have 11 nephews and nieces to my latest count. They keep growing. So I know what parents go through to some extent. And Louis C.K. says in the front of your book, parents live for tiny vacations, like when you put your kids in the car and you close their door, that little walk around the car to your door, it's like a carnival cruise.
Yeah, he really captures it. He went through a little phase. I think it was really what made him famous was he went through this phase where he talked about his kids, and he just did it so earnestly, a bit negatively, I suppose. But just, he really captured the difficulty. I mean, any parent in any given day has, unbelievable highs, just these beautiful transcendent moments of loving your kids and just feeling loved and feeling connected. And in the same time, any given parent on any given day has really some lows. So hard. It really just draws upon your resources. And he really, really captures that really well, such as in that quote you read.
Right. And you've got a sense of humor, obviously, Misadventures of a Parenting Yogi. It's not a parenting book, per se. It's a book about a parent who parents. Tell us a little bit about the book in your own words.
Yeah, I would say it's a book that, one of my aims is to make people laugh, to point to the, crazy and funny and bizarre and weird just aspects of parenting and all the crazy things. Like I grew up kind of a bit of a neurotic, germophobic kind of guy in New Jersey. And, here I am with two kids squatting in the bathroom of a Whole Foods. And, there's like any number of puddles of strange colored water. And, normally that would be fine. You just avoid them. But when you have, let's say, a two-year-old who's exploring the bathroom and you're chasing after him, he or she, those puddles of water are completely meaningless. It's like walking a dog. The dog doesn't think about the borders of people's houses, right?
They right, run all right.
Over. It's like that with a little toddler in the bathroom. The puddles of water mean nothing. The condensation on the metal, plumbing coming off the toilet, going into the wall, that means nothing to them. So, you know, you just, so it's a book that describes those experiences in a funny way, but also tries to share with people some of the parenting approaches that I feel really fortunate to have been exposed to in this really progressive town that I live in Massachusetts.
Right. One of the things you talk about is how freely people feel to give their advice to other parents. You compare it to where we were in the medieval days with religion. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, what that's talking about is it talks about, number one, how freely people feel to dispense their advice, although I think it's more dispense their judgment, maybe even internally, silently, you know, judging people. And then what the Middle Ages thing, I think that reference is talking about how, you know, we're in this very PC society right now where, you know, you would never comment, most people would never comment on someone else's religion. You know, you'd never say like, ugh, church again, come on. You know, you would never like tell someone, give them a hard time about going to church or, I don't know, putting on their kippah if they're, you know, their yarmulke if they're Jewish or something. But you just wouldn't comment on that.
Right,
but with parenting
right.
approaches, people feel totally free to, you know, judge each other or even comment on each other's approaches. And it's really, it's like, I would say these days in the United States, it's almost as triggering as politics and religion, maybe more so. I mean, I learned that early on when I started commenting on other people's, you know, practices. And before I was a parent, I would walk around town. I remember there was this one guy. He was like a middle-aged guy, and he had a baby. And he was walking around town. I knew him a little bit, and he was always in a rush. He always looked like he wasn't, you know, I was a meditator. I'd meditate hours every day. I had the time. I was young. I had no kids. And he would be rushing around all the time. You know that walk where your head is like in front of your body?
Yeah.
He'd be like walking around town with his head in front of his body. And the poor guy, and he looked frazzled and harried, you know, like his hair was a wreck. And I just judged him. I thought, what's with this guy? Like, why can't he get his life in order? And, you know, now that I have my own kids, I just every day I feel like apologizing to him. Every day, I say, now I understand.
You talk about co-sleeping, because that's one of the things that comes up a lot, you know, breastfeeding, co-sleeping. And I always think back to a time when my brother's kids were little. They're all grown now, but, you know, when they were like 8 and 5 and whatever. And he'd got 3 of them, and I was staying at their house on a trip, visit over to England, and I walked into the room, and he and his wife are fast. I'd gone in to turn off their alarm clock because they hadn't heard it. He and his wife are fast asleep. All 3 children are in the bed fast asleep with them. And the dog is in there fast asleep with them. I was the only one who'd heard the alarm. But I thought at that moment, it was such a special moment. And yet that is one of those things that people get upset about.
You know, there's a lot of weird things, I think, in our culture that if we were really, really in a different, you know, different culture
yeah.
or a different time in history, might seem like, why are they so obsessed with this, you know, like sleeping in cribs or whatever? So, yeah, no, co-sleeping brings up a lot of questions. And, I mean, number one, like you said, you captured, I mean, it is, it's so sweet. When my first child was born, I mean, if we hadn't slept in the same bed together, I really would have seen him like a half hour, hour a day. I was working so hard, you know, all day, making a living. And when I got home, I would barely see him. But knowing, you know, that we were kind of in the same room together, in the same bed together for half a day, every day, all night, you know, really made me feel good. So there
right.
is that really special, beautiful thing. And I think the kids, you know, they wake up and there's mom and dad,
mm-hmm.
the baby, the toddler. It is special.
Yeah, I felt like climbing right in there with them.
Yeah, it really is special. And, you know, one of the comments that people have, I don't know if it's okay to say this on the radio, but one of the comments people have is, you know, what happens to your sex life when the baby's born and the baby sleeps with you?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer to people who ask that question is, you know, there's not much sex life when the baby's first born. So it really doesn't get in the way that much.
Yeah, you made a very unflattering comment about your wife in the book, referring to her as Beowulf. She was Gwen before the baby and Beowulf after the baby.
No, but then you have to keep reading, because then I say that she turns back from the Hulk into Bruce Banner. So I mix a few metaphors there, but nonetheless, she does turn back into her wonderful self.
And she's still married to you, so obviously she took that in the good sense it was meant.
Yeah, yeah, the book has been toned down from the first draft that she got to edit, though.
You talk a lot about listening to your parenting instincts, which, you know, we would think kind of ties into yoga and meditation and tapping into what's going on. You know, so many especially new parents, and I've seen this with, you know, nephews and nieces, they want to go by the book. They want to say, well, this, they said this on the internet, and they said this in that book, and they want to follow that dogmatically. And you make reference to Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, which I've read, a good book. And he talks about how every time you follow an intuition, you strengthen your intuition. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, I'm really serious about that. You know, we joke a lot, but that I'm really serious about. It's very important, I think. I mean, I think that, you know, following, when I first started writing the book, actually, I thought it was going to be kind of a preachy book that preached the things I believed in. And then as I wrote it and explored it, I realized, you know, there's no right parenting approach. There's no one right way to do it, co-sleeping versus crib, nursing versus formula. I mean, I believe very strongly in nursing, breastfeeding, you know, over formula, although sometimes formula is appropriate for a certain family. There's really no right or wrong way. But I think really the key is for each of us to tune into our own heart and to tune into our own intuition, to tune into our own gut feeling and our parenting instincts. And the practice of doing that can be taking walks, having some quiet time, doing yoga, meditation, tai chi, basketball, whatever it is that tunes a person into their, into themselves, really, to their heart, to their gut. Could be church, could be temple. And I think that really is the one right way, and that could bring you in any direction. I think when, I mean, we all know how to care for our young, like any animal does. We really do. And I think that's so important, because when we follow a dogma, it can wind up really being very stressful. It could divide two partners. It could divide the parents. It could, and it can really just cause a lot of stress if it's too much. So mm-hmm. There's no one right way. It's important not to see something on TV or Super Nanny or Oprah or read it in a magazine or online. And even if it's what I wrote, it's important not to just stick to that. I'm just kidding. But you know, even if it's important not to just stick to that, but to really tune into what's right for each of us. Absolutely so important, really. It can, you know, relieve a lot of stress, and I think it makes for the best parenting.
Yeah, I think that's true of many, many, many things in life. We have to do what, you know, look at all the information and do what works best for us.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what yoga did for you. I want to go back like 20-some years, and you were a college freshman. You had an elective of a yoga class, and at that time, you know, it was all an all-girl class. Tell us a little bit about how that changed your life.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so when I grew up in New Jersey, and I was the number one ranked debater in New Jersey. And I don't know if you guys in Seattle know, but, you know, New Jersey folks can argue. So I'd like to say that was a significant accomplishment. So I was the number one debater, and I didn't even like arguing, actually, but I was just good at debating. And I was the number one ranked, and I was really stressed out. And I suppose that, you know, that contributed to, as a junior in high school, I came down with ulcerative colitis, which is really like an ulcer of the colon. It was a rough disease, and it made me really sick. I lost a ton of weight. I went down from 170 pounds to 140 pounds about, and I got really sick. I had low energy, and then through a number of doctors, I found the right doctor, and he put me on some meds, and it got better. And then a year later, I went off to Georgetown University and D.C., and I got really into yoga, just as a lark. I was there to study to be a lawyer of some kind, really, since I was a debater. And just on a lark, I got involved in yoga, and I really took over. I just felt really at home there. It felt like there was a joke about how the first class I went to was all women in the class, and so I was just laughing about that because I thought I was in the wrong place. I didn't know what yoga was, but I thought I must be in the wrong place. I thought I was in like a jazzercise class or,
I don't know,
like a menstruation class. Or so I didn't know where I was, a dating class. I didn't know what it was. But finally then I realized it was a yoga class because the teacher walked in and he had this huge beard and was wearing all whites and sandals. But yoga really took over. I just really, really, really loved it. It just felt like, you know, it's like when you fall in love, you see somebody and the world goes black and white except for this one person. Mm-hmm. It was like I just was in this class and I just felt like I was in the right place for the first time, really.
Yeah, interesting.
So about a year later, the colitis came out of remission, and the doctor tried using all different kinds of meds and it wasn't working. And there was talk of surgery, colostomy. It was really, really scary. And then one day, it's kind of weird, it's unbelievable, one day I realized that the days where I did my yoga practice, my symptoms were a little better. So I this was a crazy leap, but I thought, well, maybe I'll just do a ton of yoga, see what happens, and maybe the symptoms will feel a whole lot better. So I started doing yoga many times a day, just for short little bits, 15, 20 minutes, 4 or 5 times a day. And unbelievably, after 3 days, the symptoms went away. That was it. They came back 2 years later, just as it had been 2 years the last time. This time I caught it right away, went right on my yoga routine, my regimen, and again they went away, and that was it. It never came back.
Yeah, interesting.
And so, I mean, I was really grateful, of course, to the yoga.
Yeah, and of course that led to a whole new vocation. You documented this in your book called Misadventures of a Garden State Yogi. It's a memoir, right? I haven't seen that book, but it looks very funny.
That's what it's about. You know, same kind of style as the second book. I try to use humor to lighten it up, but it's the serious story of that, about how yoga really changed my life and healed me in that way. And it wasn't just the yoga postures. It started with that, but that's what woke me up, and it changed my diet, you know, the way I ate and the way I lived. I learned to, probably the most important thing is over time, it woke me up to all this stuff, but I changed the way I started showing my emotions more. I started repressing my stress less and finding stress management tools. And, you know, the book is all about that.
Yeah. One of the things you talk about in the book, you kind of mentioned this, you know, when you have a kid, there is no sex for a while because you're busy doing other stuff. But you have a marriage saver tip, if you will, in there, and say if you can find an extra $30 a week in your budget, hire a biweekly housekeeper and go out on a date. Talk to us a little bit about that, because I think it's something that is very doable, and people tend not to, you know, think you have to be rolling in money to have a housekeeper or somebody to come in and take care of stuff like that.
Yeah, I believe there's a lot to say about that. I mean, I think that, number one, to take it a little broader, in our culture, I think that people tend to feel that they have to do it all on their own. I think people feel that way too much. You know, I think I don't think we have to make it on our own emotionally. I don't think we have to make it on our own in any kind of way, even financially. I think there's nothing wrong with taking help from parents and grandparents. I don't know where we got the idea that a man or woman has to go out there and make it on their own and be a self-made person. You know, I don't agree with that, actually. I mean, I think throughout history, people did not live by that ideal. I think throughout history, people lived, let's say, in an ancestral home that might have been built by their great-great-grandparents, mm-hmm. you know, and now we move around more, so that doesn't happen. But
right.
I would say take the help. Take the help of neighbors and absolutely hire somebody, you know, to do a trade even. If money's a little tight, do a trade with a neighbor to have somebody watch the kids. And, you know, go out on a date. Go have dinner. Have some sex. Go out there and have fun. A lot of times, husband and wife, you know, or partners who are raising kids, parents, become kind of like business partners for a little while. And it's important to really let it be more than that. It's important, you know, once a week, once a month, whatever you can do, to get out there and have a little fun. Even if your baby's 3 months old, I don't know, go dancing, go on a picnic, whatever
right.
you like to do.
Right.
Go play Scrabble, whatever you like.
You talk in the book about your side of the family is Woody Allen to Gwen's Annie Hall. Tell us what it's like when you guys all come together there.
Actually, you know what? Her folks live in Canada and my folks live in Jersey. So unfortunately, it's rare that the whole troop is together. But yes, when it would happen, it would be like Annie Hall and Woody Allen. So I'm Jewish and from New Jersey, and my family, you know, at dinner, there's going to be some kosher deli and there's going to be everybody talking literally at the same time. I mean, people will be spitting across the table and talking and yelling at each other, and that's just a good time. Whereas she's from Canada, and it's a lot kind of quieter and more restrained. Nobody talks over anybody else. Nobody interrupts anybody else. Actually, my wife and I have had to work really hard on this, because if I've got a bunch of New Jersey friends together, she can't get a word in. Because in New Jersey, you don't wait for someone to pause to start talking. You just talk when you want to. It's true.
Right.
I mean, it's not bad or good. It's just the way of the culture.
Right.
Whereas where she's from, you wait for a polite pause, and then you speak your part.
Yeah, I've seen people in different families, you know, sitting there waiting to get a word in. It just depends on how you're raised and how your family interacts.
Yeah, actually, one of the first family dinners in Jersey that she came to, she was surprised, because I would say, let's say there were 12 people there, no more than 7 were sitting at any given time. And this was like a formal dining room table with rings around the napkins and everything. But really, no more than 7 people sitting in a given time. I don't know. Everybody else was just standing up, going to the kitchen, getting something, coming back like crazy.
Right. We're almost at the end of our segment, Brian. And I want to ask you something that, you know, has become a fad in certain regions. And that's little tiny babies doing yoga. What's your viewpoint on that?
Well, actually, the little tiny baby's doing yoga. That would probably be a lot of fun. I mean, there's the prenatal yoga, which is before the baby's born, is probably great for the mom. I think that's amazing. I've heard even some women say that it helped their labor and delivery, you know, when they gave birth, to have had the yogic breathing and all that. After the baby's born, I don't know much about that. It's probably a lot of fun. What I do write about and joke sort of about is the toddler yoga with the little kids, like even 3, 4, 5, 6 year olds. Nothing against it. I think it's probably great. But I have this theory that they don't really need the yoga. They're perfect. You know, they're just frolicking and happy. We parents need the yoga. You know, we need the yoga so that we can calm down. We need the yoga so we don't get so anxious and neurotic. We need the yoga so that when our little 4-year-old disappears for a minute behind the oatmeal display at Whole Foods, that we don't freak out and think they've been kidnapped. You know, we need to do the yoga so we can relax and so we can see our kids as they really are, not as we imagine they should be, but as they really are. The kids are already doing all that. They're perfect. They don't really need it.
Right. Well, I thank you for being with us today. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Brian?
Boy, I would say my big thing right now is community. Allow people in. You know, if you're a parent or anybody, you know, don't feel you have to make it on your own. Accept help. Take the help from your parents, your family, your friends, your neighbors. Let people in and let people help. But I think it makes a big difference.
Great. Thank you so much. My guest there, Brian Leaf. And he's the author of Misadventures of a Garden State Yogi and Misadventures of a Parenting Yogi and other books, too. And also, he's the owner of the New Leaf Learning Center in Northampton, Massachusetts. And you can find out more about Brian and his work and some of his magazine articles at misadventuresofayogi.com, misadventures-of-a-yogi.com. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Mm-hmm.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, international and New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry returns to talk about his latest historical thriller, The Lincoln Myth. And Tina Welling helps open the flow of creativity through nature. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. See more information at conversationslive.net and follow us on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Hello, I'm Eric Crema, Operations Manager for Alternative Talk 1150. We value your opinion and invite you to 1150kknw.com to fill out the 2014 KKNW Listener Survey. Your responses help us shape KKNW to your listening needs. As an added bonus, just by filling out the survey, you will be entered to win a trip for two to beautiful Victoria, B.C. Complete contest details and your opportunity to help us shape the station can be found at 1150kknw.com. So log on now.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Remember, you're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We just talked about the misadventures of a parenting yogi with Brian Leaf, and I'm very pleased to welcome now Wendy Aronson. She's been a licensed psychotherapist since 1981, and she's in private practice in Greenwich, Connecticut. She's a guest lecturer and consultant at area schools and Parents Together. And she developed and facilitated the Learning Differences Network for the Junior League of Greenwich in conjunction with Greenwich Hospital. She also serves as facilitator for the Parent Exchange with Greenwich Hospital. And she's written a new book called Refeathering the Empty Nest, Life After the Children Leave. Wendy Aronson, welcome.
Well, thank you. So nice to be here.
And it's nice to have you. I was just saying before we came live that I happened to catch you on Katie last week. And so I got to see you in person, if we will, through a television screen. But it's good to have you on the show now. So I love that you call this refeathering the empty nest and not just that empty nest syndrome, because that sounds kind of hopeless somehow.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about why you called it that.
I feel that that is just that. I don't think the nest is empty. We're still in it. And just because our children have left doesn't mean that we don't have a nest. And it means that the nest just takes a different form, and it should look different now that they have left. So that's why I wanted to say refeathering, that this was an opportunity rather than such a daunting time in our lives.
Right, right. So for many people, parenting has been their career or their second career, depending if they work outside the home or not. But they've invested, obviously, a lot of time in their children. And it can be quite devastating to some if they're not fully prepared for it. You talk about there being a major shift, the shift, as you call it. Talk to us a little bit about the shift.
Yes, it can be devastating to some. The shift is a time that I say that begins to occur when the youngest child prepares to leave for the nest, and that it impacts all aspects of this everybody's life. So whether it's the child's life, the relationship to the child, your relationship to your spouse, your friends, your career. So the shift impacts 360 degrees. And preparing for it is something that starts with awareness, and it can start with children as they begin to become more autonomous.
So what kind of things are we looking at? We're looking at kids, the shift starting really when they're in the teenage years, and they don't want to hang out with you anymore.
That's exactly right, exactly. When they don't want to be with you as much, or they're not there as much, they're with their friends, they have a driver's license, they're out at night on the weekends, whereas you used to go to the movies with them. Even at some point, they don't want to go to the movies with you. They'd rather sit home in their room and just talk to their friends. So that that might be a beginning. Also would be looking for, if they go on to college, looking for different colleges, preparing for going on to college would be another beginning. All of these things are the beginnings of pangs of feelings that we might have as our children begin to separate from us.
Right. But they're also the beginnings of new stages of life that we as parents can take to heart and rise to the challenge. So I like that you say beginnings rather than endings.
Yes. Yes, it is. Because as I talk about in the book, I see this as a time of, you know, I call this time with parents, free-range parenting. And, you know, kind of like the chickens, they don't have the same constraints they once had when your children are in the home. So there are so many different possibilities, and their responsibilities have so lessened, so that there's so much opportunity for themselves, for other relationships, another career, hobbies, reinventing themselves.
Right. And this is not just something that affects women. I think maybe traditionally when the woman stayed home, but now most women do work outside the home. I mean, this is something that affects men too.
It most certainly does. And it really affects each, you know, men and women differently. I think the person whom it affects the most is the person, or who might feel it more acutely, is the person who is more assigned to the daily routines of the children, even if you have two, you know, working parents.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't, if you have a stay-at-home mom who's there front and center, she might feel it acutely, but the father might, too, who has a weekly basketball game or a weekly tennis game with his son or his daughter. So, you know, it's all about the relationship, and it doesn't preclude whether dads or moms feel that sense of loss and that shift in an acute way.
Right. So you talk about the push-pull conflict, which happens in many relationships, not just parent-child, but talk to us about it from the point of view of a parent. In this empty nest refeathering.
I didn't hear the first part, Vicki. The what conflict did you say?
Push-pull.
Oh, push-pull. Okay, I didn't hear that. Okay. Push-pull conflict does happen because on one hand, the young adults are feeling like they're ready to go and raring to go. And on the other hand, there's a lot of ambivalence about wanting to go. Conversely, you know, on one hand, parents might wipe their brow and say, boy, oh boy, this has been, you know, front and center. This is going to be our time. But even with that feeling of excitement can come a feeling of loss, can come a feeling of angst. Uh-oh, what's my life going to be like? Who am I going to be? And so that push-pull is on one hand, you know, hold me close and be next to me.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, push away that there's some independence,
right.
You know. So, and that comes in many forms. It comes in forms of wanting to, you know, be with them 24/7 as if it was their last, you know, time on this earth. And on the other hand, they kind of push them out the door by maybe nagging them or, you know, doing things that might preclude or might begin some kind of conflict.
Right. So it is a very definite balancing act, and it's going to be different for each child and each parent's situation. But do you see something that is probably the most common mistake that parents make?
The most common mistake, I think, is not letting go. And by that I mean staying so connected and so attached at the hip that it doesn't really allow their young adult the ability to, you know, spread their wings and become autonomous. And conversely, it doesn't allow you as the parent to move on to the shift and move on to the next stages and the next opportunities that could be offered to you.
Yeah.
So holding on too tight.
Yeah. And very quickly, because we're right at the end of our segment, Wendy, but I think this is an important point, and you do talk about this in the book. You know, the baby boomers are known as the sandwich generation. They've still got kids probably at home, still helping them out with college or, you know, a new home. Then they've got elderly parents they're trying to take care of. And oftentimes, over the last few years, kids have had to move back because of economic situations. So the parent is taking care of them financially too. How do we have that money conversation when they return home after being out of the nest for a while?
Well, I think the money conversation comes in really with the whole conversation of communication and really being clear about what your expectations are, you as the parent. Are you expecting for, you know, there to be a timeline for how long they're staying with you? If they are staying with you, what are the expectations? Are they helping out? Are they doing chores? Are they paying rent? It really just depends. You know, there's not one recipe because every family is very different. But it's very, very important to be clear about your expectations, have those communication open, because they are not returning as the same people who left. They are returning with hopefully 4+ years behind them of college or whatever career that they've had. And you too are not the same. Your life has evolved. So there is a lot of rhythms that need to be readjusted when the young adult returns home.
Yeah, I like that, adjusting to the rhythms, the new rhythms. Love it. Well, the book is called Refeathering the Empty Nest, Life After Children Leave. My guest, Wendy Aronson, she's a licensed psychotherapist and has been for since 1981. And you can find out more about Wendy and her work at wendyaronsonicsw.com.
LCSW.
LCS.
Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for correcting that. I couldn't see. It's in very faint print.
LCSW.
Right. Wendy Aronson, LCSW.com. Thank you, Wendy, for being with us. Appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And before we go to break, I very quickly just want to say that KKNW is running a survey right now, and your responses help the station. But more importantly to me, they help me as an independent producer and radio host. So if you could take a minute, I would love if you could jump onto the contest rules, which are on 1150kknw.com. And just log on there and let us know what you like about the show, what you'd like to see more of, the type of guests, the type of topics. We would really appreciate it. KKNW, I know, would appreciate it, and I would too. Please stay with us. We're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be back with Dr. Jamie Kaufman. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to relationship whisperer Jana Rosewood, we cover the world of living successfully with your animal friends. This week, June 15th, it's Vet Sunday with Dr. Bill Burlingame. Dr. Bill's the most knowledgeable, balanced, open-minded vet I know, and he's in the studio. We'll discuss the best immune system support for us and our animal friends, Pluckner syndrome, cancer, laser therapy, plus open phone lines for your animal medical care questions. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, International and New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry returns to talk about his latest historical thriller, The Lincoln Myth. And Tina Welling helps open the flow of creativity through nature. Join us every Monday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. See more information at conversationslive.net. And follow us on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Hello, I'm Eric Crema, Operations Manager for Alternative Talk 1150. We value your opinion and invite you to 1150kknw.com to fill out the 2014 KKNW Listener Survey. Your responses help us shape KKNW to your listening needs. As an added bonus, just by filling out the survey, you will be entered to win a trip for two to beautiful Victoria, BC. Complete contest details and your opportunity to help us shape the station can be found at 1150kknw.com. So log on now.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Some people know a good thing when they hear it. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we are talking in this segment about what I introduced at the top of the hour, saying that more than 20 million Americans suffer from what's known as enigmatic chronic cough. And we have a leading expert here to talk to us about that. Dr. Jamie Kaufman is one of America's leading laryngologists and as such has become one of the world's leading authorities on reflux disease. She lectures nationally and internationally and is professor of clinical otolaryngology at the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary of the New York Medical College. She's received numerous awards where she's been recognized by her peers for the work she does, including a Lifetime Achievement Award for research and publications in laryngology. And Dr. Kaufman has been listed among the top doctors in America every year since 1994. Dr. Jamie Kaufman, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you again.
And I want to let listeners know, last time we talked about your other book, Dropping Acid, The Reflux Diet Cookbook and Cure. Today, we're talking about your new book, The Chronic Cough Enigma, Acid Reflux, Asthma, and Recalcitrant Cough, the Path to a Cure. So let's just get a couple of things out of the way here, because you start the book out with these, and I do think it's important to share this information with our listeners. First of all, you are not and do not claim to be a pulmonologist. You're a laryngologist. And
correct.
Secondly, you were motivated to write this book, you say, because the ideas and approach presented in your book were rejected by mainstream medicine publication. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, first of all, I'm very much of an iconoclast in this realm. I actually take care of the entire aerodigestive tract. That big mouthful means the entire breathing passages from your nose, voice box, and throat to the root of your lung, and the digestive passages, really from your tongue and your throat and your esophagus and your gullet and your stomach and your intestines. Turns out this is one system. One of the big problems in healthcare today is fragmentation of that system. So that you might have, for example, one doctor take care of the esophagus, and another one take care of the lung, another one take care of the throat, another one take care of the sinuses. In my opinion, this has resulted in a can't see the forest for the trees kind of phenomenon, and it's a big phenomenon.
Yeah, in the book you write that 40% of the patients you saw had reflux-related cough, 14% neurogenic cough, which I want to talk about in a second, and 46% had both. So tell me, the first thing you say we've got to do when if we're having this constant cough, and let's talk about the cough, what type of cough too, but when we have a persistent cough, the first thing we should do is go to a pulmonary specialist, correct?
Well, you should see your family doctor first and let them do the usual things. They may want to get a chest x-ray or then refer you to a lung doctor. But in many cases, the cause of the cough may be obvious if the right questions are asked. If you cough after meals, if you cough lying down, if you wake up in the middle of a night from a sound sleep coughing, that's not asthma, it's reflux. People who have trouble bending over and people who may or may not have heartburn or indigestion. So reflux-related cough is quite common, and if we think maybe looking at the big numbers plus the percentages, there may be 20 million reflux coughers, and that's a lot of people. The reason why that's a big number and it's an important number is those are the types of people that go from doctor to doctor and don't get a good outcome.
Right. One of the things I remember from last time is that we don't always know that we have reflux. Now, it's called different names by different doctors, like silent reflux or acid reflux. Or talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Vicki, your point is extremely well taken. Each specialty has a different name. The public thinks of acid reflux as being heartburn and heartburn being acid reflux. In fact, that's not true. The gastroenterologist decided to take the most obvious symptom and say heartburn's reflux, reflux is heartburn, it's esophageal, and we own it in the 60s and 70s. But we now know that most people who have acid reflux, that is the backflow of stomach contents, including acid and enzymes, into the throat, into the breathing passages, into the lung and the sinuses, without having heartburn or indigestion, that is without having typical symptoms, i.e. heartburn. So that's why we call it silent reflux. Reflux affects 40% of the American population, and most of it's really related to diet and lifestyle. But the symptoms, we should go through those first.
Right.
A sensation of a lump in the throat, post-nasal drip, chronic throat clearing, too much throat mucus, hoarseness, particularly morning hoarseness, difficulty swallowing, pill sticking, breathing episodes, problems, choking episodes, asthma, allergies, and sinusitis. And I might say that silent reflux is the great masquerader today. It is allergies that aren't allergies, sinusitis that isn't sinusitis, and asthma that isn't asthma.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense to me because I was told I had asthmatic allergies and I didn't really buy that, I guess, and I certainly didn't want to take all the sprays and medication I was given. And after we last talked, I paid attention to how I felt after I'd eaten and have eliminated them because I have a sweet tooth, but I have reduced a lot of the stuff that I noticed was making me clear my throat and cough after I'd eaten it.
Well, I think it's an important observation. I would like to share, however, two of mine that I think are crucial. The first is that asthma affects 1 out of 12 Americans, and it's 17% of poor non-white children. That's almost 1 out of 5. In my experience, 4 to 5 people with asthma don't have asthma. Let me say that again. 4 to 5 people in America with asthma don't have asthma. They have silent reflux. We waste $1 billion a week on this misdiagnosis. So here's the key, and I'm sort of on a campaign, if you will. I want to teach everyone in the nation, in or out. And what does this mean? If you have trouble breathing, if you have an asthma attack, ask yourself this question. Do I have more trouble getting the air in during inhalation or out during exhalation? During exhalation, that's asthma. But everything else is reflux. If you have trouble getting the air in, it's not asthma. It's never asthma.
Yeah, I was going to say that again. And sorry, I was talking over you, but I think that really surprised me.
Everyone should know this. If you have trouble breathing in, it's not asthma.
There we go.
It's reflux. Reflux in the throat. It turns out there are some receptors, the switches, and guess what triggers them? Acid. So if acid comes up and trips those switches, the throat closes down. So it's the throat closing down and not the lungs. Lungs closing down, that's asthma. Throat closing down, that's reflux.
So it most definitely is often misdiagnosed then. What is the gold standard for testing reflux?
Well, there is no gold standard, which is part of the problem. And your question is as pointed gets. Nowadays, the symptoms... there's something called the reflux symptom index, which is in both books. If your symptom index is greater than 15 and you fill that out yourself, the chances are very, very high that you have silent reflux or at least reflux. And the laryngeal examination, looking at the throat, we now know that there are findings on throat examination that'll tell us for sure whether someone has reflux into their throat. And, of course, the throat reflux, that's the one that gets confused with asthma, sinusitis, and allergies.
Right, right. So let's talk a little bit about the book, The Chronic Cough Enigma. Your book was, the foreword was written by Suze Orman, who said that she had been Suze Orman, of course, is the financial TV personality.
Well, she was interesting because she was diagnosed as having asthma at age 14.
Mm-hmm.
And as she started to, get into really full adult years, she was having more trouble with chronic throat clearing and cough. They still called it asthma. And Dr. Oz suggested she see me, and we took a look, and sure enough, I said, I think this is reflux and not asthma. So we treated her reflux, and all of this went away after whatever it was, 40 or 50 years of suffering, after wondering, am I going to be able to get through my show after multiple takes and retakes because of throat clearing and coughing. It was done, over, finished.
Right.
So it was a big deal for her, and it was a big deal for her to write this forward because she understands that there are millions of people in the same predicament.
Yeah, so you talk in the book about neurogenic cough. I wonder if you'd talk a little about that because I wasn't familiar with that.
Neurogenic is a very tricky term. Neurogenic means caused by the nerve. Turns out there's this very important nerve. It's a funny story for me because the last clue in Double Jeopardy, maybe last month, was the longest cranial nerve, and I went, what is the vagus nerve? And none of the contestants got it. The vagus nerve is a very important nerve about which almost no one knows anything. It controls swallowing, speaking, digestion, cough, speaking, and almost all the functions related to the throat and the breathing and the digestion are all regulated by the vagus nerve. This vagus nerve gets sick. Sometimes you get a virus and the vagus nerve gets sick. Now what happens is the nerve misbehaves. So, for example, if I were to touch your leg and you went, ow, and then I touched your leg again and you went, ow, that touch wasn't an ow. It was a gentle touch. But somehow your brain thought it was an ow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call neurogenic cough. It's a cough where the tickle and the triggers are all wrong. And they make someone cough, for example, change in temperature, going into air conditioning, fumes, perfume, diesel fumes, speaking, singing, talking on the phone. These things should not cause cough unless there's something wrong with the switching system. And so it turns out that neurogenic cough and reflux-related cough, they're the big two when you talk about enigmatic cough. And, of course, enigmatic is just a fancy word for saying puzzle, the chronic cough puzzle.
Right.
So anyone who's coughed more than 8 weeks has a chronic cough, and if it's enigmatic, if it's a puzzle, most of the time it's going to be the sick nerve syndrome we call neurogenic cough or reflux, even if it's silent reflux. Those are the two big causes.
And if they have that sick nerve neurogenic cough, is that curable?
Everything's curable. In fact, what's really cool about the vagus nerve is there's something called neuroplasticity. So if you can knock out the cough for 6 months, which we can do with very light medicines that are atypical medicines, not used for acid reflux or for cough usually, but special for the nerve medicines. We give those in light doses for a few months. The cough subsides, and then there seems to be a reset. In other words, people don't have to stay on those pills forever.
Right. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. A final word you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, if you have silent reflux, or you think you might have silent reflux, the Chronic Cough Enigma has a really nice section called Dr. Kaufman's Reflux Boot Camp. But if you really want to find me, just Google Dropping Acid. Dropping Acid is really the book about how we discovered problems in the American diet and reflux.
Right. Well, I thank you for being with us today, Dr. Jamie Kaufman. Always a pleasure and good information. The book is The Chronic Cough Enigma. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And before we shoot off today, I just want to remind you, or if you've just joined us, that KKNW is having a survey, and it's happening right now, the 2014 KKNW Listener Survey. If you take a few minutes just to respond to this, it will help the station better tailor its programming to your needs. And, you know, from my perspective as an independent producer and host, it will help me tailor our programming here at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. So I would really appreciate you telling us what you like, what you'd like to see more of, topics, guests, etc. It would be really great to hear from you. As an added bonus, just by filling out the survey, you'll be entered to win a trip for two to Victoria, BC, including a tour, lodging, and all the taxes. It's all taken care of. So lucky person's name will be drawn on Monday, July 7th. Please log on to 1150kknw.com right now if you have time. If not, do it later and fill out the survey. We'd really appreciate it. And I want to thank you for joining us today. We will be back next week with an all-live new show. If you have comments, feedback on today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or info@conversationslive.net. We're also on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and you can find me on Twitter simply at Vicky St. Clair. Thanks for being with us. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.